Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
Hey, y'all. Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Crossover NBA podcast, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. What's happening, Beck?
What's happening? I just have one question. Are you enjoying Rivals Week in the NBA? The spectacular, scintillating, historic rivalries in the NBA.
The NBA will do anything it can to make January, February games relevant. Anything. That includes this awful idea of a midseason tournament, which we're not going to get into, but the midseason tournament has been and always will be a bad idea and a desperate way to make fans care about January, February games when the only way to do that, Howard, is to reduce the number of games, which nobody is going to do. So,
which Steve Kerr just alluded to again a few days ago, and which every time, you know, Jimmy Butler not playing last night, now granted he was hurt, but like, the more we have players and sometimes major players and sometimes multiple stars missing games, it just speaks to too many games and problems with keeping faith with your fans who are paying a lot of money to come see these guys. Like, all of this is wrapped up together. And I kid about Rivalry Week. I actually do like the fact that the NBA creates this and tries to give us a new hook in late January in what are clearly, by everybody, everybody knows this, these are the dog days of the season. So that's fine. It's just really the fact that, like, in an era where guys change teams constantly and every era for any given team lasts maybe 5-6 years at most, you can't really build any rivalries. Like, the best rivalries we've had in the last week are Shannon Sharp versus Dylan Brooks. Shannon Sharp, not an NBA player, last I checked, seems to want to join the fray. And like Pat Beverly versus Damian Lillard, which, by the way, I'm all in for that, much more so than anything a TV personality is doing. But there just aren't, right? Like, Knicks and Nets, yeah, kind of. Lakers, Clippers, okay, fine, sort of. Warriors, Memphis, a little bit, but like, you got to have a history. There just is no history between any two teams anymore to really call it a rivalry.
No, the NBA does Rivalry Day. It's called Christmas Day. Like, that's Rivalry Day in the NBA, when you get some of the more organic rivalries to take place. But otherwise, it's just a desperate way to try to get people to care more about regular season games. All right, we are going to talk about Pat Beverly's Lakers. We are going to talk about Damian Lillard's Blazers. But right off the top, Howard, one of the more interesting stories this week was by our friends over at The Athletic, who had a more detailed look at some of the reasons, some of the issues that Bob Myers may be having with Golden State. It was reported by ESPN a couple of weeks back that Bob Myers does not have a contract with the Warriors for next season. I think a lot of us myself included, believed that eventually they would work it out, similar to the same way Monty McNair and Wes Wilcox just worked things out with the Sacramento Kings, despite not having a contract for next season. But if you read this Athletic report, there may be some underlying reasons why Bob Myers will not return. What were your takeaways from that reporting?
I mean, I think this is the first time, and really, you know, great detailed report there, and because of the information they have there, it's the first time that I looked at this situation and thought, you know what, maybe this actually will be the end. And they heavily alluded to the idea in that report that, you know, that we're reaching a point in this era, in this dynasty, this Warriors dynasty. Pieces are going to start to peel away. Whether that's Bob Myers, whether it's Draymond Green deciding not to opt in this summer, whatever it may be, like, we're getting close. And it's just kind of a question of which figures kind of decide to peel away first. When I first had heard of Bob Myers and the Warriors being at sort of an impasse or there's no contract for next season, I thought of this as analogous to Masai Ujiri in Toronto a few years back, where we thought, oh man, is someone going to finally steal Masai? Like, the Wizards were tied to him. The Knicks were tied to him. The, you know, franchises with great resources and big markets that could potentially try to blow Masai away and you know, poach him from Toronto. But it never came to pass. They came to terms. Masai is doing quite nicely for himself with the Raptors still. And I thought, with Bob Myers as well-regarded as he is, as successful as he is, everything, like, why would you even mess with that? And so I thought for sure they would resolve this. Joe Lacob, the Warriors majority owner, had said to our friend Tim Kawakami, again at The Athletic on his podcast a few weeks back, that, you know, kind of tamping down the whole thing, it'll be fine, we'll take care of it. Bob is one of the highest paid executives in the league. Well, the report from The Athletic today is basically, no, he's more like sixth or seventh. And for a guy who has more championships than any, you know, active executive, I believe, in the NBA, he should be top two or three or one. And for a franchise that's never been afraid of spending into the hundreds of millions counting luxury taxes, it's a little strange that they're going to hold a hard line there. But they do allude to, and this is the last major point here, maybe the idea that Bob Myers too just has other challenges ahead of him for his life. I don't mean challenges like obstacles, that he may aspire to do other things, whether it's revive another franchise and build them up, whether it's something outside of basketball, perhaps. I mean, you and I both know Bob well, really dynamic individual and a great guy. Like, I could see him doing any number of things. Doesn't have to be in the NBA. But I do wonder, Chris, I wonder if this could be the end. And if it were, like, what that would indicate for the Warriors as we reach kind of the late stages of this dynasty.
Yeah, I think if you're Bob Myers, this is an opportune time to look in different directions, because even though Golden State has a few more years left with this group, even if Draymond walks, you've still got Steph, you've still got Klay, you've got young pieces there that presumably are going to get better. There's a pathway to keep this window open over the next few years. But you got to also take a look at the landscape here, and The Athletic kind of alluded to this. You've got some franchises out there that could be looking to make a change at the top. Out east, I don't know what's going to happen with Washington. I don't know what's going to happen with New York, but Bob Myers would make some sense in those situations. But more specifically, look at Los Angeles. Bob Myers is a UCLA guy. You've got the Clippers, who, if they don't win this year, there's going to be some change. And by win, I mean advance deep in the playoffs, probably to the conference finals. If they fizzle out in the first round, it's not a stretch to say we could see some changes in LA. The Lakers, I think it's doubtful that Rob Pelinka would be on the way out after this season unless they completely implode down the stretch. But, you know, if there's an opportunity to grab Bob Myers, maybe the Lakers are looking at an executive like that. There just is the potential to be a bidding war for this guy's services, and he could revive some marquee franchise. I mean, how many times, you know, do you have an opportunity to look at the Knicks, to look at the Lakers, look at the Clippers, and put yourself in that particular situation? So I think if you're Bob Myers, like, maybe you want to stay in Golden State, you're comfortable there, Steve Kerr, you're close with, the guys on your roster, you're close with. But if you were looking at the options out there, this summer might be as good a time as any to leave.
The franchises you mentioned, for sure. You know, the Clippers, it's interesting too, because, like, I think they've got a really talented front office, that has always, I think, moved in lockstep or has had full buy-in from Steve Ballmer, the owner. And, you know, on the basics, you and I disagree about this Clippers era on some level. But on the basics, look, they did what they set out to do. They rebuilt that team really smartly before they got Paul George
their
and Kawhi Leonard.
Their luxury tax payroll is in, like, come on, their payroll's out of control. For that kind of payroll, which Steve Ballmer doesn't mind paying, by the way, for that kind of payroll, you got to do more than just make the playoffs.
Of course. And of course, if you have spent all that money and gone to these great lengths, and of course they're building a new arena at Steve Ballmer's cost, you want the payoff, of course. But do you have a really talented front office that has done the right things? Yeah, they did great when they had when they were creating the atmosphere to want to get Paul George and Kawhi Leonard to want to come. They built up a team. They used their cap room wisely. They used the draft picks wisely. They did all that. They got these guys. There have been injuries. There's been circumstances. Yes, you're right. The end result may be what it is, and that may lead Ballmer to want to push them out or go a different direction. That's possible. But I would say in general, if I'm looking at teams that just need somebody with Bob Myers' talent, his acumen, his track record, his credibility, the Lakers for sure. Interesting because I think he and Rob Pelinka worked for the same agency for years as co-workers. The agent model as GM has not always worked out for every team that's tried this. Jury's still out on the Knicks and the Leon Rose era. Jury definitely out on this part of the Rob Pelinka era in LA. And yes, I understand they won a championship. We don't need to go chapter and verse on all the missteps there. But those are two teams. You mentioned Washington. There are others. Bob Myers would certainly have, I think, no shortage of suitors. Pelinka just signed an extension, we should remind people, too. Like, I don't
Correct.
Think...
That's why I don't think they're going to rush into...
And Jeannie Buss clearly has tied... Yeah.
Yeah, he's got loyalty there. Plus, you know, one of the biggest problems with an outside executive looking at the Lakers, whether it's Bob Myers, Sam Presti, any of the other guys that might be available to go and get for the right price, is that these guys are going to come in and say, I'm bringing my own guys. Bob Myers was probably going to say, I want Mike Dunleavy in as my right-hand man. Bob Myers or Sam Presti or anybody else with any credibility is going to say, look, Jeannie Buss, you are the owner. You have final say. You obviously have basketball input, but I am not listening to your brothers. I am not listening to the Rambi. I am not listening to any number of people within an organization that wield influence that probably shouldn't wield influence on a franchise on that level. So that's a difficulty. Rob Pelinka, to his credit, is threading the needle out there in Los Angeles, trying to do his thing while getting input from a whole bunch of different people that on other franchises probably wouldn't have quite as much input.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. Anybody of Bob Myers' talent, and I said the same thing when it was Masai Ujiri and there was discussions of or speculation about him going to the Knicks. Like, if you have a certain level of status in this league and success, you have the ability to go in and say, listen, you guys have not run this well. You have been listening to the wrong people, or you have too many cooks in the kitchen. If I'm coming in, I need full authority, full autonomy to rebuild this thing the right way. And Bob Myers has that kind of sway or that kind of power given his credibility and his track record. So yeah, and that might cut off certain opportunities because some of those teams may not be willing to give that kind of autonomy to someone. But I think it'd be fascinating. And of course, you know, the other aspect of this is whether he goes to another team or whether he just leaves, period. Steve Kerr is really tight with Bob Myers. Those guys have worked fantastically together. Mike Dunleavy Jr., as you mentioned, who's in that front office, is very close to Bob Myers. Steph Curry, Draymond Green, number of other players close to Bob Myers. Like, all these key figures, you know, it's not that a franchise can't move on. Listen, Jerry West left the Lakers after Shaq and Kobe won their first championship, handed off to Mitch Kupchak, and of course, they'd already been working in lockstep together, and things just continued on. It's not to say that a GM leaving means the end of things, but the Warriors are at that late stage anyway because of age and miles and everything else where it's getting harder. You're seeing some frayed edges. And I Myers leaving both symbolically and practically, I think, would be, let's just put it in kind terms, a serious inflection point for that franchise if he were to go.
Well, it could be the beginning of a domino effect because Steve Kerr is close with Bob Myers. Would Steve Kerr decide it's time for him to take a break or maybe take on a new challenge? I don't know, maybe. Other guys in the front office might follow Bob Myers where he goes next. So it's a pivotal moment, that's for sure, within the Warriors organization. All right, let's go back to the Lakers for a minute because they made a trade. The Lakers made a deal, Howard. A mega deal. Well, not so much, but it's not bad.
We have like one of those little like hallelujah choruses we can drop in. Angels singing something.
We'll leave that to production. Rui Hachimura, ex of the Washington Wizards, ex number 9 pick in the draft. He is headed to Los Angeles. Kendrick Nunn. We hardly knew you, Kendrick Nunn. He is going to Washington along with three second round picks. You're right, we don't know. Your initial thoughts on the Hachimura for Nunn and picks trade?
On the Lakers side of it, look, it's a good opportunistic move. They gave up a player in Nunn who wasn't obviously that vital. They had a backcourt logjam, to say the least. Nunn has been hurt since he's been there. Never really contributed, and they trade him plus some second-round picks, none of their ultra-valued golden ticket first-round picks that they don't want to part with unless they're, you know, getting, like, you know, a new Ferrari or something.
And they had a lot of second-round picks, so they had a lot of second-round picks. Like seven
that's
or
what
eight
they're
or
for.
Something like that.
Yeah. That's what they're for. You take your seconds, and you take a role player, and you send them on to a team that is looking to unload somebody. Good move by Rob Pelinka and his staff, a good opportunistic trade. And in Hachimura, you get size, you get length, you get some athleticism and some versatility that they sorely needed. Like, he's not going to change the world for them. Like, he's not a great shooter. He shot, it's interesting, he shot 447 from three last season, but he's a career 35% shooter from three. He's down to 33.7% on threes.
Yeah, bottomed out this
season.
Year. Yeah.
Yeah. Overall. Now, playing alongside a healthy LeBron and soon to return, if not already returned, Anthony Davis, he'll get a lot of open shots. He'll get a lot of driving kick type shots and just stand out there in the corner and wait. And he's a great catch and shoot 3-point shooter. That percentage could go up. But they've been undersized a lot of the season. They've had a lot of 3-guard lineups. The reports early on seem to suggest that when Anthony Davis is back, Thomas Bryant goes back to the bench. So now you've bolstered your second unit. The indication there was that Hachimura may be starting with LeBron and AD. By the time this podcast airs, maybe we'll have already seen that. So look, it's a nice, modest, short-term move. But in the wake of it, you also have Rob Pelinka then telling LA reporters, you know, that there are no developmental moves. There are no in-betweens when it comes to those first-round picks. Well, you just made an incremental move and the kind of move you should make. Even if the next move requires a first-round pick to be moved, the idea is still to build towards something sustainable, something meaningful, something that gets you somewhere in the playoffs this summer. So the signaling, or the mixed signals and the reticence that still seems to be there about making a bigger trade or using those firsts, I think would be a little concerning, but hey, look, good move by the Lakers and another bad sign for the Wizards that a guy who was a lottery pick for them just a couple of years ago has to be offloaded for, you know, basically, a bag of beans.
Yeah, 3 second round picks. Look, the Wizards, we'll leave that alone, put it on a shelf for a moment. But that Rui was a disastrous pick for Washington a few years ago. If you look at the list, I think our friend Mark Stein or Tom Ziller, one of them had a list of on their Substack of the guys picked after Rui Hachimura. There's like 6 or 7 guys that are legitimate NBA players that Washington could have used. Instead, they got a guy they pulled the shoot on after 3 years. So, bad pick. That didn't work out for the Wizards. Now, will it work out for the Lakers? Well, I agree with all that you said. Although, you know, Hachimura is being pegged as this like high-level defender in some circles. I'm not sure I see that. He's solid. He's big, sturdy, physical. That can help. And he's, when you look at the Lakers' front court rotation, he can be one of those guys that can play both forward spots when needed. So that's going to be useful. The 3-point numbers you talked about, he's good at the corner threes, about 42% from corner threes this season, which is probably an area the Lakers are going to put him, as he's playing kind of off driving kick from LeBron James. That's what Kendrick Nunn did a lot of too when he was in LA. 41% the last couple of seasons on catch and shoot threes. That's a pretty good number as well. I expect these shooting numbers, Howard, to improve because, you know, I've said this many times before, shooters get better when they're playing next to LeBron James. They just do. So I expect Hachimura to have more open looks. And based on what we've seen from him, he's probably going to be able to capitalize on a lot of them. The other part of this is, I think the Lakers believe that there's something untapped in Hachimura because in Washington, there was a logjam there, especially this season. You had Kyle Kuzma, who the Wizards bizarrely seem very committed to. We'll get to them. You've got Denny Avdija, who was another lottery pick. That's someone the Wizards were giving minutes to as well. So in Hachimura's case, he didn't have the kind of opportunities perhaps the Lakers are going to look to give him. So maybe there is something untapped in all that. I mean, all they gave up was Kendrick Nunn, and let's raise a glass for the two-year run for Kendrick Nunn in Los Angeles. I mean, how many times do we hear, Howard, that Kendrick Nunn was going to be the answer? All last season, don't worry, when Kendrick Nunn comes back, he's going to make an impact with this team. Darvin Ham talking him up in the preseason. I was at those practices where Darvin Ham was talking about how Kendrick Nunn looked. He was not the answer. Had a pretty good month of January, if you look at some of the numbers, but he wasn't the answer. And with the Lakers getting all they needed from Pat Beverly, Dennis Schroeder, Russell Westbrook, Austin Reeves, that backcourt rotation is fine. It made sense to offload Kendrick Nunn in that situation. So I think this is a move that makes them incrementally better, to use your word there. I think they do improve based on this deal. The other part of it is, I think it now makes them a little bit more likely to make a bigger win-now trade before the deadline, because they get Hachimura. And whatever you think of 3 second-round picks, if you think they're inconsequential, the Lakers don't. Like, the Lakers didn't give up 3 second-round picks for a 3-month rental of Rui Hachimura. They gave up those picks. They're expecting to sign him to some kind of contract. Now, the Wizards, they were talking to Hachimura, but they couldn't come to a, they weren't even close, really, from what I was told, on a deal for his next contract. So Hachimura is going to have an excess of $10 million, probably between 10 and 15 for a salary over the next 3, 4, 5 seasons, whatever it is. And I think the Lakers are going to give it to him. I think, and if they do that, that's going to eat into their cap space for next year, to the point where if you have, you know, right now, if Hachimura goes off the books, you're talking about $34 million in available cap space. That's enough money to go out there and get a marquee free agent. But if you bring Hachimura back, even if it's on $10 million, $12 million, $15 million, that cap space is basically gone. So with that cap space gone, I look at the Lakers saying, well, maybe they are more inclined to move Pat Beverly and a first-round pick. Maybe Russell Westbrook is more on the table now than he was a couple of weeks ago. I think the Lakers have become even more of a team to watch before the deadline, whether that is for Bojan Bogdanovic in Detroit, Christian Wood in Dallas, any of the Utah guys that are available over the next couple of weeks. I think the Lakers are now in play way more than they were before this deal happened.
Yeah, I agree with that, in part because of something you just said. They acquired Hachimura with the thought of re-signing him this summer. And if you assume that that's going to happen and it cuts into their cap room, well, then you have abandoned the one of the previous rationales for not making an all-in deal now was not just sacrificing future picks and what that may do to your post-LeBron future, but also it was, well, no. We don't want to trade Russ plus the picks because Russ is going to come off the books and we'll be a cap room team. And whether that meant chasing Kyrie Irving or Wizard Kyle Kuzma, former Laker Kyle Kuzma. Again, quick wrinkle there. Wizards offloaded Hachimura in part because they want the money to spend on giving Kuzma a new deal, assuming that he wants to resign.
I can't with that. Just real quick, our friend Candace Buckner wrote a good column in the Washington Post.
Phenomenal column.
Over the last couple of days. Like, basically giving voice to everything we're all thinking right now. It's like, what are the Wizards doing? Like, what is the plan here? Like, you're going to go out and pay Kyle Kuzma, who's going to want like $20 million a year or more. You're going to bring back Kristaps Porzingis if he opts out of his contract. So you'll have a Beal, Porzingis, Kuzma core, which is going to gobble up most of your cap space.
And leaves you
where? What does that get you? Like, what does that get you? If they had drafted better, like, then you might say, okay, but like, Corey Kispert, like,
why is Kuzma resigning there, by the way? Why? Like,
I don't know. I mean, money. Like, if the Wizards are going to pay him a bunch of money, that's why Bradley Beal resigned there. Like, I'm not Bradley Beal. It's laughable to think that Bradley Beal was going back just to be the one to revive Washington, to be the one to take the Wizards to a championship. He got paid. I don't begrudge him that. He got 5 years and $250 million. That's why you go back. And if they open up the checkbook for Kyle Kuzma, he's going to go back too. But I don't know why Washington would want to do that. Because it doesn't, all it does, if they're all healthy, Maybe that gets you like the 7th seed. Maybe that gets you the 6th seed. It does not get you among the upper echelon teams in your own conference.
No, it doesn't get them. It doesn't get them much closer. It's you're still, you know, a player away that you can't now acquire because you've got every you know, all this money locked up in these other three guys. Only one of whom has been an all-star. Actually, two, Porzingis counting him from very early in his career, but Porzingis is not making another all-star team, most likely. Kuzma's probably not making an all-star team. Bradley Beal may not be making another all-star team in his career. So you lock up three max contracts with three guys who are not making all-star teams. You have doomed yourself to the treadmill of mediocrity. I agree with you that the Lakers...
Can we make that the episode title, please? Treadmill of mediocrity? Can that be the episode title? I'd like that.
I agree that the Lakers... having weathered the storm without Anthony Davis and him coming back potentially within minutes of this podcast dropping, and at 22-26, like the record suggests that they suck, but they are only a game and a half out of the last play-in spot. So they're still very much alive, and one bigger, bolder move involving at least one or maybe both of those future first-round picks might really put them firmly in the mix. And so, as I have been saying from the get-go, I don't think you just cash out on a season where LeBron's playing at this level. Man, some of the footage of him in that loss last night, he just looked absolutely despondent. But I agree that this should make them more aggressive. One, they've weathered the storm without Anthony Davis. Anthony Davis is now healthy. Two, Hachimura does help kind of stabilize their rotation, as does Thomas Bryant's emergence during Anthony Davis's absence. Like, for a 22-26 team, they're in like solid enough shape that one big bold trade, I don't know what it is, but yes, I would expect they should be aggressive over the next couple weeks heading into the trade deadline. Before we leave this topic, though, I just got to note my favorite footnote of this entire conversation in this trade. Do you know how many members of the 2020-21 Wizards are now on the Laker roster?
Oh, man.
Four.
One, two, four. Yeah, I was going to say four.
By the way,
Thomas Bryant, Russell Westbrook, now Rui Hachimura. Who's the fourth? What am I looking
for? Troy Brown Jr.
Troy Brown Jr., that's right. These guys are getting minutes too. Like, all these guys are playing minutes.
Four members of the Washington Wizards, including three of their top four scorers, all but, of course, Bradley Beal, the one guy they'd probably like more than all the other guys that they've gotten from the Wizards.
I believe the Wizards were a non-playoff team that year too, right? Like, that's so.
The Wizards went 34-38 that year, were smoked in the first round by the Sixers in a 5-game series.
Oh, they played in the playoffs. All right, yeah.
But yeah, Beal was the leading scorer on that team. Westbrook was number two, Thomas Bryant number three, Hachimura number four in the leading scorers of that Wizards team. All of them now Lakers, along with the 16th leading scorer for the Wizards that year, Troy Brown Jr. Just bizarre.
Yeah. Look, I will readily acknowledge that NBA executives are a lot smarter when it comes to the game than I am. They are. But sometimes I look at situations and I look, what am I missing? Like, what is the reason to commit, like, what, like $40, $80, $100 million to Kyle Kuzma, Bradley Beal, and Kristaps Porzingis? Like, what methodology, what formula am I missing where that makes sense? I don't get it. All right, from one team that I don't know what they're doing to another that I'm not so sure about what they're doing. The Portland Trail Blazers are out there. As we record this, they are 12th in the Western Conference, a game and a half back of the number 10 seed. They have lost, I believe, 4 of the last 5 and was it 8 out of 11, something like that, over the last month or so. We had Chris Haynes over at Bleacher Report reporting that the Blazers are looking to be buyers going into the trade deadline. I don't know, Howard. Like, ever since they gave Damian Lillard that contract, I have been wondering what the end game is here for this team. Is it to be as competitive as they possibly can during these last prime years of Damian Lillard's career, or is there a grander plan at play? Because right now, this team is what this team has been for years. They are a very good offensive team, ranked in the top 10. They are a terrible defensive team, ranked in the bottom third. Their starting lineup is very good. Their bench is very bad. So I don't know what the upgrade is out there that's going to make them measurably better. I mean, you've also got Jeremy Grant, who's sitting out there on the last year of his contract saying all the right things, saying he likes Portland, he'd like to resign here, all the stuff we've heard from many players in the past, but he's been extension eligible for a few weeks now, and he hasn't signed anything. So, you know, if I'm Portland, maybe I'm a little bit worried about the possibility of keeping Jeremy Grant, who will be a sought-after guy in free agency this summer. So what do you think about what's going on in Portland right now?
You know, listen, I was never as adamant as you were that they should just, you know, punt and trade Dame over the last year or two. We've had that discussion a couple of different times. But I have been curious.
Not
and
just
I was,
offload, just to be clear, not just offload him, but like the last couple of years, he was the kind of asset that would have brought back a huge yield. Which
right,
would
a bridge to
you,
the next era. Yeah.
Yeah. All the things that, you know, all the things, frankly, that Utah did when they traded Gobert and they traded Mitchell. They left themselves pick rich with a bunch of young guys. They could have kept Simons. They could have kept some of the other young guys on the roster and built that way.
Yeah. And listen, you and I have had the discussion too before about Lillard and McCollum all those years. And I thought that they waited way too long to trade McCollum. It took until after Neil Olshey was out until Joe Cronin took over and could like move CJ McCollum. Neil Olshey was never going to do it. It was the right thing to finally break up that backcourt, as good as Lillard and McCollum were, that just they needed something different. And Anthony Simons' emergence helped foster that as well. I liked the move for Jeremy Grant. If you're going to stay the course, I like the move for him. If you're going to stay the course, I like the move even for Gary Payton II. But he's been hurt a lot, and maybe that's part of why they've been slow to get that defense to come around this season, is that a key guy they brought in to help their defense. No one guy changes your defense, by the way, unless it's, well, unless it was Rudy Gobert in Utah, but not in Minnesota. Yeah. Anyway, rare that one guy, especially a non-shot blocker, non-rim protector, is going to single-handedly change your defensive complexion of your team. But they made the right effort, right? They went out and got guys like Payton and Jeremy Grant for that purpose. And it hasn't worked out. You mentioned it. They're number 8 overall in offensive efficiency. I think they're 22nd in defensive efficiency. They just haven't been able to get it together there. And they've got some good players. And Dame Lillard is playing like at an all-NBA level again. Yep. And Simons has been fantastic. And, you know, like there's good pieces there, but they're not better than the sum of their parts. And, yeah, I don't know where this goes next. And I don't quite understand. Like, if you've already been this all in, right? Like they could have taken the pick that became Shaedon Sharpe, who may become a really great player. A lot of people very high on him, but he was the 7th pick. I thought at the time that they, after they cashed out on last season, Lillard's hurt, they shelf him, they you know, kind of, you know, soft tank. I thought the 7th pick was one where if you're going to say we're still all in on the Lillard era, you trade the 7th pick for immediate help. They didn't. They drafted Sharpe. I don't know at what point Shaedon Sharpe is going to be a vital enough player to help during the Lillard era or what's left of it. So they're caught in between, like a lot of teams get caught in between, of the hanging on to the star you have and the era you have versus trying to plan for the future or deciding it's time to shift to a different agenda. And they're still caught in between. But if you've gone this far, Chris, if you've gone down this far down the road of keeping Nurkic and acquiring Grant and acquiring Josh Hart, who again, good pickup for them in that McCollum deal, maybe you might as well just keep on this. Maybe you are still one player away from at least being a solid playoff team again, and that's the best way to make use of Lillard's stardom, you know, for whatever years he's got left.
Do you really believe that? Like, do you believe, like, you know, maybe they're one player away from being the 6th seed, which earns them the right to get evaporated in the first round. Like, I don't know what the point of that is. And like,
no one's getting evaporated in the first round in this Western Conference this season. I will just say for this year,
if you're not an elite defensive team, you're going to get beat up in the first round. Like if you're not at least a middle of the pack defensive team, you're going to get beat up in the first round. It's just, I just fully believe that. I do like the reason I push so hard and say so often, like teams should blow it up. Like whether it is, you know, what's happening right now in Portland or what's happening right now in Washington is that I look around and the teams that do it, it generally works out. Like, use a couple of GMs as an example. Danny Ainge, right? In Boston, he had a team that if he kept that group together, Rajon Rondo, Paul Pierce, Kevin Garnett, that would have been a good playoff team with a chance to make the second round of the playoffs. In Utah, nobody said you had to get rid of Rudy Gobert and Donovan Mitchell. Rudy Gobert had just signed a contract extension. Donovan Mitchell had multiple years left on his contract. You didn't have to do anything. But Ainge saw the value in selling high on his stars. He could sell Rudy Gobert to a desperate team like Minnesota that wanted him, and he might have gotten a player, forget the picks, a player in Walker Kessler who might turn out to be, like, at least for right now, better than what they had in Gobert. And, you know, you look at what Sam Presti just did in Oklahoma City. Like, he had a team that was out there, Chris Paul, Dennis Schroeder, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, some other pieces there. He could have added to that group if he really wanted to. Chris Paul probably wanted out, but he could have added to that mix and kept being a playoff team, kept being a contender for the second round, but he sold high. He sold Chris. He had already sold high on Russell Westbrook and Paul George. And then he sold high, got picks in exchange for Chris Paul from the Phoenix Suns. The point is, when you see the writing on the wall, when you see that there's virtually no pathway to win a championship, I think it's your obligation as a general manager to sell high on your guys, to give your team the assets to build it back up and potentially put yourself in position to win down the line. Now, I know that's difficult because not every general manager has the job security of Danny Ainge or of Sam Presti. But if you're looking at this objectively, the right thing to do was a couple of years ago, opening, or even a year ago, looking at the market for Damian Lillard and saying, look, Dame, talking to him, not just dealing him anywhere, but saying, talking to him, say, Dame, we don't see a pathway to a championship here. We got to try to figure this thing out. Let's work together on finding the right situation for you and for your family. They didn't do that. They extended him. He's now under contract forever. And while he is going to go down as the greatest Blazer in team history, I don't know if it's worth it. Like, is it worth it to just be kind of a fringy playoff team for the next couple of years? Because unless Shaedon Sharpe takes a massive leap and unless they get lucky on their next draft pick, I don't know how this team gets to the level that I'm sure Damian Lillard wants them to be at.
I'm going to put it this way. I admire what Sam Presti has done and the boldness it takes to say, you know what? We're blowing it up and starting over. We're spinning off Paul George, and we're going to cash out in a major way. We're going to get all these picks and swaps. And
just to clarify one thing, Howard. Just to clarify, I do think Presti was forced into
because
Paul George Westbrook. Paul George wanted out. I think Sam would have kept that team together for one more year, but it all worked out for him because once Paul George was like, I want to go somewhere else, the Clippers were just desperate. They gave up everything. And then somehow they got the Rockets to do that Westbrook-Paul deal that got them a bunch of draft picks as well.
Yeah, a bunch of forces were kind of conspiring at the same time, and Sam Presti saw an opportunity to sell off both Westbrook and Paul George to restock for the future and rebuild. And it's coming to fruition much faster than I think anybody could have anticipated. People think about the Thunder of having been like, oh, they've been tanking forever. It's been like a couple of years. Like
2 years.
Their playoff quote-unquote drought is shorter than a bunch of teams that have been quote-unquote trying to win over the last several years. We will not name names. So that's working out very nicely. I admire what Sam did there in that moment. I admire Danny Ainge, what he's done in both Utah and Boston at pivotal moments like this. I believe in being bold. It's easy for us to say that from our seats here behind the podcast microphone. But teams have other people they have to answer to. GMs have to answer to their fan bases and the owners of these teams. And sometimes, especially in a market like Portland, it's difficult to decide we're going to give up one of the greatest players, not just in Blazer history, but in NBA history. He made the 75th anniversary team, Lillard, to decide to trade that player when all he has said all along is, I'm all about Portland and I want to be here. And he has not come to you yet that we know of and said, I want out. To decide to proactively trade him is difficult. It does mean you are, you know, it functions on all these different levels, a business level, an emotional level, the fan level. It is difficult to do. I'm not saying on principle that I disagree with you. I think there's a lot of merit to the idea of 2-3 years ago, especially deciding it's time to trade Damian Lillard. Just as with the Wizards, I thought forever ago they should have traded Bradley Beal. But every situation is a little unique in terms of, you know, again, market forces, fan base, ownership, whatever. And again, I think it's really difficult with a player of Dame Lillard's stature, unless he's going to be the one to come to you and say it's time to proactively deal a player, trade away a player who is that beloved and that successful in your franchise's history. It's tough.
It's very tough, but it's your job. Like, you are, I'm sorry, you are paid millions of dollars to make these difficult decisions. It is your job. And I just look at Portland and I almost, look, Dame has been incredibly loyal to that franchise, incredibly loyal to that organization, has used some variation of 10 toes in, talking about them at all times, and proven that every single night. But if you're going to sit there and argue with me, not you specifically, but if anyone's going to argue with me that there is a pathway for the Blazers to get to a championship level in the next 3 years, Lillard's 32 right now, he'll be 33 this summer. We'll give him like 3 more years of playing at a pretty high level. If you're going to tell me there's a pathway to get to that championship level, I'll have that argument all day long because I don't see it. I don't see how it's ultimately happening. All right, last thing for you, Howard. Both of us submitted our All-Star ballots over the weekend. Some tough decisions in the starting lineups for both Eastern and Western Conference. Give me your toughest decision, the one you agonized over for days, weeks, hours, poring over your laptop, just making phone calls, checking in with all your sources. Who was it?
You forgot the vast spreadsheets and analytics. I wore out my abacus in the process.
You analytics nerd.
Got to replace a few beads on the abacus. There was actually one very, very difficult decision in each conference. In the East, I ultimately went with Embiid over Giannis. So my front court was Durant, Tatum, Embiid. Very, very difficult to leave out Giannis. But to me, Tatum was a lock. He's the MVP candidate. Durant, though he's missed time, at the moment that we filed our ballots, he'd only missed 4 or 5 games. He's in the MVP discussion. He's got to be a lock. It became Embiid versus Giannis for the last one. And the fact is, the Bucks have kind of, I don't want to say flatlined, but plateaued over the last month and a half. They haven't been all that great. Giannis is part of that. His shooting has been a problem for them. And Embiid and the Sixers have been surging. And Embiid's been fantastic at both ends of the court. Their records at the time when we filed the ballots were nearly identical. So you couldn't lean toward Giannis based on wins. And Embiid's shooting percentages, I think they were even from 2. Embiid is better from 3 and better from the foul line. So his effective field goal percentage was higher. His true shooting was higher. It's by the slightest of hairs that I took him over Giannis. I also had a difficulty in the West, but we can circle back to that if we got time.
Yeah, I also struggled with that final spot in the front court in the Eastern Conference, and I did the same thing. It was Embiid versus Giannis. And it's not the end-all be-all, but as I mocked advanced analytics, you see those Raptor rankings that 538 does. You had in the top 5 Tatum, Durant, and Embiid. Giannis was 26th in those Raptor rankings, which is kind of wild, but sort of indicates that.
Remind me the formula for Raptor.
Oh God, well, wins above replacement, something. I don't know. But it's generally a respected ranking for some of those.
Yes,
but
yes,
that was that was the one that I struggled with as well. Also, the second backcourt player in the Eastern Conference, Donovan Mitchell was an obvious choice to start.
Lock.
I went with Jaylen Brown as my second.
Same.
Because I think Jaylen has had just an unbelievable offensive year. I think while he's not as good defensively as he's been in years past, he's still really good, and he's one of the catalysts for the best team in the NBA right now.
I didn't struggle with that one at all. Mitchell and Brown for me was easy. The other difficulty for me was in the West. Two places, right? So I went with Doncic and Curry in the backcourt. Curry over Ja Morant was a little tough considering, Steph missed a lot of games, but I'm sorry, I'm giving him the Steph Curry exception, just like we have the LeBron exception. He is so great, and is also going to be great in an All-Star game. It is, that is for the fans, all that stuff. I have no problem putting Steph in ahead of Ja Morant. Ultimately, Steph is still the better player. I know he missed a ton of games, and he's been back for a couple of weeks. The really tough one was the third front court spot. LeBron and Jokic. Yeah, LeBron and Jokic were locks. It came down to Zion versus Lauri Markkanen versus Domantas Sabonis. Mm. And as of Friday, when I taped with David Aldridge for the Friday crossover pod, I was leaning Zion. And then by the time I got to Saturday to filling out my ballot before the deadline, I had reevaluated and I ultimately went with Sabonis. Zion, way too many games missed. And the fact is, look, the Kings, top 3 team in the West now. Sabonis is a huge reason for that. It's not just his scoring. Like, he's the least scoring, has the least scoring of the three
18,
of those guys.
19 points per game, something like that, yeah.
But by far the best playmaker of the three, the highest assist percentage of the three, great efficiency, and has revived a Kings team that has, you know, been, you know, a dormant and a doormat for 16 years. And I just think we need to recognize and reward that. At one point, this case for Markkanen included the Jazz being revived. Well, the Jazz aren't revived anymore, folks. Like, no. They're back where we thought, where we all projected they would be. They've sunk. And to the extent that winning is not the sole factor for all-star selections, but it should be at least a serious consideration, I think Sabonis over Markkanen easily. And look, the Pelicans have sunk a bit without Zion and Ingram. That's not Zion's fault, but he's just been out too long. So ultimately, it was still a difficult decision, but I feel good about going with Sabonis for that last spot.
I did the exact same thing. I didn't factor Markkanen in because of how far the Jazz have fallen, at least as a starter. If Zion had been healthy, he would have been a lock for that third spot,
yes,
because of how he was playing before, yes, the hamstring injury, how the Pelicans were playing before the hamstring injury. If he had not missed these last couple of weeks, he would have been a lock. But at some point, you got to reward the Sacramento Kings for what they're doing. And Sabonis, along with De'Aaron Fox, has been a catalyst. I was writing this, you know, I mentioned the Eastern Conference. Tyrese Haliburton was somebody I considered for a starting spot alongside, you know, instead of rather Jaylen Brown in the conference. The Haliburton-Sabonis trade has worked out for both teams, like, flawlessly. Like, Haliburton, yeah, is the driving force behind the Pacers' success, and Sabonis, along with Fox, are the driving forces. And Fox, who is probably better because Halliburton's not there and he's not sharing the ball handling responsibilities, they are driving force behind the Kings' success. I thought Sabonis deserves it. The Kings deserve a starter. That was my pick for that spot as well. I like that we're in lockstep here, Howard. Maybe maybe we'll be the outliers. I don't know, but maybe that bodes well for Sabonis' chances for starting the All-Star game.
Unusual for you and I to be that much in agreement, I think, on our ballots for just about anything. I mean, there's, yes, at least usually a couple of points of contention. So surprise, you and I had not shared, the listeners should be aware, we had not shared our picks at all until just now, although, yep, I mentioned mine where I thought I was heading on the Friday pod. But yeah, I'll be very curious to see how this goes. And listen, we're going to find out Thursday night who the starters are. 50% by fan vote, 25% media vote, 25% player vote. You never know where the players are going with anything because those votes are all over the map. We know probably where the fan vote was going because we've seen the initial returns, you know, over the last few weeks. But, you know, I'm very curious for a couple positions in particular. Those third front court spots in both conferences, whether Kyrie ends up as the starter. He's been the fans' choice up until now to start alongside Donovan Mitchell. Will the players push him in? Will our media brethren have him high on the ballots? Very curious to see how this all pans out.
Yeah, Kyrie kind of in that, not exactly the Zion camp, but the dysfunction of the first couple of weeks of the season. Putting up numbers now. Like, you look at his numbers, they're great at this point. He still is an elite player, but
And they have not been winning a ton without Kevin Durant, which, correct, I think reflects as well on him.
Maybe, how do you like maybe, but like, you know, you drop a top guy from any team, they struggle. We saw with the Pelicans, like, you know,
sure,
how they've struggled. So I don't
know. Are you on board with the captains picking on the court playground style before the game? I know you've been sneering at every gimmick the NBA comes up with. I love this. I'm all in on this.
It's fine. Like, it's gonna make it funny who the last pick is. Like, the last kid picked.
Well, but it was on live TV when they were doing it on TNT beforehand. Also, it's doing the suspense of doing it on the court live with the players there. That's far more interesting. It was already kind of fun. There was definitely like some stuff going on, some shade being thrown and everything with the live picks on TNT.
I feel like if Sabonis is not a starter, then he's going to be the last guy picked. Because I don't know who picks the versatile big man.
How about Markkanen will make it as a reserve probably.
Yeah, that's true,
and it's in Salt Lake City. Like, do you want to be, are the two captains both going to serve him the indignity of being the last one picked in his home market, or does somebody say, you know what, you could be the hero, pick Markkanen, the fan, of course it's a corporate crowd that's probably mostly they're not Jazz fans, but you could endear yourself to the Utah crowd by picking him earlier.
I don't think that's on the mind of LeBron James endearing himself to the Utah crowd as he's making those selections. Howard will be back on Friday, and we will do this next week.
Oh, it's a pleasure, my friend.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.